Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you can have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
I'm Nancy Cordes in Washington, and this week on Face the Nation, breaking news overnight as a U.S. Osprey crashes in Australia with 23 Marines on board. And three people are killed in a racially motivated shooting in Jacksonville, Florida. We'll have the latest on both stories. Another first for the American presidency last week, a booking photo of former President Trump after he was charged, along with 18 others, with conspiring to overturn the 2020 election results.
We did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. And everybody knows it. I've never had such support.
Trump may be right about that support, as his campaign says they've brought in more than $7 million, thanks in part to mugshot merch. And his competitors?
Please raise your hand if you would.
Most, including former Vice President Mike Pence, say they'd support him for president even if he's convicted. We'll talk to Pence, along with former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who feels much differently.
Someone's got to stop normalizing this conduct.
Have you seen Donald Trump's mugshot yet?
I did see it on television.
What'd you think?
Handsome guy.
We'll have analysis and talk about the complicated legal calendar with our political panel. Then, a childcare cliff looming next month and a bipartisan duo hoping to prevent it. South Carolina Republican Nancy Mace and California Democrat Ro Khanna will talk about the millions of children who could lose their care if Congress doesn't act. And finally, Russia expert Fiona Hill weighs in on the mysterious plane crash that killed Russian mercenary chief Yevgeny Prigozhin after his failed coup attempt against Vladimir Putin. It's all just ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. We've got a lot to get to today, but we want to begin with that crash of an Osprey aircraft carrying 23 U.S. Marines. Three of those Marines are now confirmed dead, and five more have been seriously injured. It happened during a multinational training exercise on Melville Island in Australia's Northern Territory. The incident is under investigation, and we will update you as we learn more. The other breaking story, a dollar store in Jacksonville, Florida, is the site of a racially motivated shooting yesterday. CBS News correspondent Christian Benavides reports from the scene.
A heartbroken community left reeling after officials say a gunman opened fire inside a Dollar General store in Jacksonville, Florida, killing three people before taking his own life. All three of the victims were black. Police say the suspect was motivated by hate when he walked into the store Saturday afternoon wearing a mask and tactical vest.
Plainly put, this shooting was racially motivated and he hated black people.
In writings left behind by the gunman, who is described as a white man in his early 20s, authorities say he described his hateful ideology. This picture, released by the sheriff's office, shows swastikas drawn on the AR-15 style rifle he used to carry out the attack.
We stand together as a community. We live together as a community. We fight together as a community. And when someone comes into our city and does this, we're not going to stand for it, and we don't accept it.
The FBI has opened a federal civil rights investigation and will investigate this as a hate crime.
The shooting happened less than a mile from Edward Waters University, a historically black university. In a statement, the school said they believe the suspect was on campus earlier in the day, but left after being confronted by a security officer.
That was Christian Benavides reporting from Jacksonville. We want to turn now to politics and former Vice President Mike Pence, who joins us from Indiana this morning. Mr. Vice President, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Nancy. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. I want to start with this shooting in Jacksonville. You know, here we are. It's the eve of the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington. And yet we're appearing to witness a rise in racial hatred, in white supremacy across the country. What can you do? What can your party do? What can the nation do to address this?
Well, there's no place in America for racially inspired violence, and I condemn what occurred in Jacksonville in the strongest possible terms. That wasn't a criminal act. That was an act of evil. Our prayers are with the families who lost loved ones and those that are injured. Karen and I prayed this morning for them. And as a Marine Corps family, we also prayed for the families of our Marines that were lost and injured in the Osprey crash. We believe in prayer at our house, Nancy. But look, this issue of mass shooting is one that I think we need leadership in this country afresh. I will tell you that I believe that there's a series of steps that we can take, providing law enforcement with the support that they need, ending this long experiment of defunding the police by the American left. I think we need to provide federal funding to provide armed guards at all of our public and private schools. We need a commitment to institutional health care in this country that I've called for many months ago. But at the end of the day, I also believe that justice delayed is justice denied, and I'm calling for an expedited federal death penalty for anyone engaged in a mass shooting like took place in Jacksonville, or frankly, like the shootings that took place at a baseball park and at a football game. We've got to send a message to anyone that has evil in their hearts that there is no chance for them to spend the rest of their life behind bars, that they're going to meet their fate in months, not years. And I believe an expedited due process, a federal death penalty for those that engage in the kind of mass shootings that claim lives in Jacksonville yesterday is an idea whose time has come.
Understood. Let's turn to the Republican primary. There was a moment that a lot of people will remember from the debate the other day, and that was when all of the candidates were asked whether they thought you did the right thing on January 6, 2020. Let's listen quickly to how some of them responded.
Vice President Pence did the right thing.
Mike Pence did the right thing on January 6th.
Mike Pence stood for the Constitution.
Absolutely. He did the right thing.
Mike did his duty. I got no beef with him.
Can you tell us what it felt like to get that kind of validation from your fellow Republican leaders after all the abuse you've taken from the MAGA wing of your party for the past 2.5 years for that? For simply doing your job on January 6th?
Well, Nancy, it was heartening, but it wasn't anything new. Frankly, as I've traveled around this country for the last 2.5 years, Americans from every walk of life have come up to me and expressed their appreciation for the fact that we did our duty that day. Look, I, as I said, I understand the disappointment in the 2020 election. I was on the ballot But under our Constitution, states certify elections, and once court cases and reviews and recounts are completed, the only duty of the vice president is to preside over a joint session of Congress where those votes are open and counted. And I welcome the fact that almost everybody on that stage made it clear that I did my duty that day. And I think the American people deserve to hear where every single one of the candidates for the Republican nomination stand.
Yeah, I want to ask you about one of those candidates, entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy. You had some criticism of him on the stage. You said the country can't afford to have a rookie in the White House. I wonder what you make of his voting record. He is listed as an unaffiliated voter in his home state of Ohio. He didn't vote in the 22 primaries. He has acknowledged that he didn't vote in most presidential elections, and he describes himself as a, quote, American nationalist. What's your view of his politics?
Well, you know, where to start? We had a good, vigorous debate, which is, you know, which is why you have primaries, Nancy. And I welcome the chance to contrast my longstanding commitment to the conservative agenda and frankly, the fact that I believe in all humility that I'm the most qualified and the most tested candidate in this race, not only with Vivek, who I've known for several years, but for everybody else on the stage. I mean, look, I think this country's in a lot of trouble. I think Joe Biden, from that disastrous withdrawal in Afghanistan 2 years ago this week, to his policies that launched the worst inflation in 40 years, mortgage rates went up to a 22-year high yesterday, burdening families, their war on energy, the crisis at the border, the assault on our liberties. Now is the time, I believe, for leadership that knows how to move the Congress, knows how to move an administration, but also has led a state and made the hard choices of a chief executive at the state level. And so I was happy to contrast that with regard to his voting record.
We're talking about Ramaswamy here, if you don't mind, Mr. Vice President. He said that he would pardon Mr. Trump. You were one of six candidates on the stage who said that you would support Mr. Trump even if he is convicted of a felony. Why do you feel that way, especially since you also said on the stage that you felt that he asked you to put him before the Constitution? Why should someone like that be president?
Well, I signed a pledge to be on that stage to say that I'd support the Republican nominee. I remain confident, more confident after Wednesday night, that the Republican nominee will not be the former president, that we're going to give the American people a standard bearer for the GOP that's going to be able to lead us to victory against Joe Biden and the radical left. But so, you know, I raised my hand just to say that I'll support the Republican nominee because, Nancy, I could never support Joe Biden. I mean, Joe Biden's policies have been disastrous. He and his family are under an ethical cloud themselves. And frankly, Joe Biden has trampled on the Constitution of the United States. He's failed to faithfully execute our laws at the southern border of the United States, created the worst crisis in American history. And that student loan giveaway where he was going to ask truck drivers to pay their taxes to pay off the student loans of graduate students was essentially an unconstitutional power grab that I rejected. So I'll support the Republican nominee, and I'm going to continue to work my heart out to make sure that it's me.
Mr. Vice President, we'll be looking forward to the next debate and seeing you there. Appreciate you joining us this morning.
Thank you, Nancy. Good to be with you.
We turn now to former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Governor, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Nancy. It's good to be here.
Let's get right to it. Do you take issue with former President Trump making money off of his mugshot?
Look, there's almost nothing anymore that he could do that would surprise me in terms of the ongoing grift. You know, Donald Trump promised the country when he ran in 2016 that he would drain the swamp. Really, all he did was rearrange the swamp. Rearranged it so that he could make money off of regular voters to pay his own legal fees, to pay $208,000 for his wife's stylist, and to set up a $2 billion grift from the Saudis for his daughter Ivanka and his son-in-law Jared. You know, we see the same thing with Hunter Biden and what he's doing. We have two ruling families right now in this country who put themselves before the people they're supposed to represent. We need a wholesale change, and that's why I'm running for president.
You think Trump supporters are being ripped off when they donate?
Absolutely. You know, when you see $40 million in legal fees in just the first half of the year, and that was before two of the indictments, these fees are only going to go through the roof. And Donald Trump maybe should sell one of his golf courses or maybe sell his apartment at Trump Tower to fund it. But instead, he's taking people who donate an average of $100 to him to try to get him to become president of the United States again. And he's using that money to pay his legal fees. It's unethical. It's immoral. And it's just another part of the grift that's been going on in Washington, D.C. for much, much too long. And, you know, you look at him and you look at what's going on, as I said, with Hunter Biden and the way he was selling access to his father when he was vice president. I think that we should be tired of both of those acts.
You know, you said at the debate, and it got a lot of attention, that candidates need to stop normalizing Trump's conduct. But you stood by him after he was accused of rape, after he praised Vladimir Putin repeatedly, after he was impeached. Didn't you normalize his conduct for a long time as well?
The conduct I'm talking about, Nancy, is the one that is the greatest threat to our country and the greatest threat to our democracy. And that was standing in front of the cameras from the White House behind the seal of the president on election night and telling people the election was stolen. And for now, 3 years nearly, continuing to say the same thing with absolutely no proof and no evidence. That's the problem, Nancy. You know, you can have policy disagreements with someone, and believe me, I spoke out at the time about the things that I disagreed with Donald Trump on. That's much different than taking classified documents from the White House and hiding them for 18 months from the government claiming you don't have them, when these are some of the biggest secrets in our country's arsenal. It's different than undercutting democracy in the way that he was doing so, and leading to the riot we had on Capitol Hill on January 6th. You know, I'm going to get on that stage and I'm going to tell the truth, regardless of what other people may think. That is the truth. And that's why, you know, I urge people to go to ChrisChristie.com, donate to support the truth, because that's what we're standing up for.
One of Trump's 18 co-defendants in Fulton County is his former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, who you know. And he's going to be in court tomorrow arguing that his charges should be moved to federal court because the conduct in question happened when he was serving in the federal government. You are a former federal prosecutor. What do you think of that argument?
He's got an argument to make, Nancy. There's no doubt that under the statutes, there's an argument to make. But ultimately, all of these change of venue decisions are at the discretion of the trial judge here, a federal judge, who's going to be hearing that. And he's going to want to hear all the different evidence and the balancing of the interests. And these venue decisions are made on that basis. So is there an argument to be made? There's definitely an argument to be made about switching venue to federal court. But in the end, it really won't change matters all that much, except that the trial won't be televised. It still has to be governed under the state laws of Atlanta. The only thing that will be different are some of the procedural things that lawyers care about. But in the end, all the charges must remain the same. So I think that whether Mark Meadows wins that motion or doesn't is not going to make a substantive difference on how ultimately a jury is going to be asked to make these decisions at the time of trial.
I want to move to an issue that a lot of Republican voters in particular care about, which is immigration. On the debate stage, a couple of your opponents seem to suggest that they would send troops into Mexico to fight the drug cartels. Governor DeSantis said he would deploy U.S. special forces. Do you think that that is a viable solution to the fentanyl crisis? Wouldn't Mexico view that as an act of war?
I think they would. And look, I see it also as an act of war by China to be sending the precursor chemicals to these Mexican drug cartels in order to make the fentanyl that they're sending up into the country. Look, I think there are ways to get this done. I think we have to use our intelligence assets. We have to be much tougher and stronger at the border to prevent people from coming through, finish the wall that Donald Trump never finished, only built 52 miles of in 4 years. We need to make sure that we put National Guard at the border to stop those folks from coming across the border with fentanyl. I think the invasion of Mexico issue is one that sounds good on a debate stage, but I think if any of them tried to implement that part of it as president, they would find it's much more complicated and that they're making it sound.
Wouldn't it be illegal to have the National Guard serving in a law enforcement capacity at the border?
No, Nancy, look, I think that what we're doing is protecting the border. They would be working with Customs and Border Patrol folks hand in hand. They can effectuate the arrests, but you obviously need greater force there to prevent them from coming over the border in the first place. And so it's a combination of the two of them. Customs and Border Patrol would still be the law enforcement agency, but they need backup. They need help. And they're not getting that right now from the Biden administration.
Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Nancy. Have a good Sunday.
Face the Nation will be back in 1 minute. Stay with us.
Sound the gifting panic alarm. We've all been there. You need to find the perfect gift. You have absolutely zero ideas and you don't know where to start. Relax. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode takes the stress out of gifting, so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. Just answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like, and Gift Mode gives you curated gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. Imagine pages of artisan espresso mugs for the coffee connoisseur in your life, or for the pickleballer, customized paddle covers in every shade imaginable. Etsy's got you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
We are back with South Carolina Republican Congresswoman Nancy Mace and Democratic California Congressman Ro Khanna. Together, they launched the Congressional Bipartisan Affordable Child Care Caucus. That's a mouthful, to deal with the child care cliff that is barreling down the pike. And I want to get to that in just a moment. But first, I want to talk to you about politics. Congresswoman, President Trump is now facing 4 indictments, and yet he is still the overwhelming favorite to win the Republican nomination. Can your party win the presidency if he's the nominee?
Well, I think both sides are going to have to work hard to win next year. I talked to a lot of voters that are frustrated with both the Republican and Democrat Party. Both parties have put us on the spending cliff. You talk about child care cliff, which we'll talk about in a moment, but both parties have contributed to the inflation that we have today, the out-of-control spending, the debt ceiling that's going to add almost $20 trillion to the debt over the next 10 years. And I think both parties are going to have to make a strong case next year, regardless of who the nominee is. But, you know, we'll see what voters decide next year.
You think Trump is a good messenger for that
case?
He's
running away with the nomination process now. We're still pretty far out, but he just raised over $7 million after the 4th indictment. So voters will get a say. I know that in my district and in my state, he's the standard bearer for the nomination right now.
Congressman Khanna, you said back in April that you felt that the White House was being too overprotective of the president, that it basically wasn't letting him get out there enough and be his authentic self. Do you feel that top aides in the White House got that message?
I think they do. The president has a great story to tell. He's bringing back manufacturing in Ohio, $20 billion in Ohio of new industry. He's focused on the working class. I was actually just in South Carolina yesterday with Bishop Green at AME Church, and the faith community has a lot of support for him. He's a better politician than anyone who works for him. Let him be out there.
Congresswoman Mace, you are pro-life, but you've also said your party's too extreme on abortion. And on the debate stage the other night, many of the candidates put their support behind a national abortion ban at 15 weeks, perhaps even earlier. Your fellow South Carolinian, Nikki Haley, was not among them. She said that that's unrealistic. But do you think that position is going to hold up well with the GOP primary electorate?
Well, certainly every candidate talked about being pro-life and what their limits may or may not be. But the only candidate on the stage that talked about how we should protect women and not demonize them was Nikki Haley. And that is a message that we have to carry through. We have to be pro-woman and pro-life. You cannot go after women and attack them because they make a choice that you don't like or do not agree with, because it's a very sensitive subject right now. We want to show that we are going to protect women who've been raped, girls who are victims of incest. We want to make sure that every woman in this country, regardless of where she lives or how much money she makes, that she has access to birth control. Those are the kinds of things, and we're going to talk about child care in a minute, but those are the kinds of things that really matter to women. And we have to show that we care. And I did want to add that I know that you were praising President Biden, the story that he has to tell, but the story he won't tell is a story about his family's business. He has lied every single time he's been asked about his family's business. He's lied about his involvement. He had a pseudonym. Like, you've done, if you've done everything up above board, why is there the need to lie for it? That is a story that I want to hear. That is a story that every American deserves
to
hear.
If I could just respond to that. Representative Mason,
quickly,
I agree on a lot of things, but this president has shown integrity for 40 years. He has been completely transparent. He has allowed the law enforcement agencies to take their hold without interfering. And I think the American people will see that.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. I'm Nancy Cordes in for Margaret today. And we are back with Republican Nancy Mace and Democrat Ro Khanna. And the two of you are here because the U.S. is facing a so-called child care cliff that most parents probably didn't know about. On September 30th, just a little over a month from now, $40 billion worth of pandemic-era funding for the child care industry is set to expire. And without it, up to 70,000 child care facilities could close, and an estimated 3.2 million children could lose access to child care. These numbers are really frightening. What can the two of you do about it? And how quickly can you get legislation together so that Congress could consider it before the deadline?
Well, it's staggering, the challenge before us. And Congressman Khanna and I, we've been good friends. We've been great lawmakers together. We've started a child care caucus. Our approaches may be different from time to time on different issues, but our goals are always the same. And these are issues that parents, especially moms, that they care about, and we have to address. From the perspective that I'm looking at, you know, we talk about four-year-old pre-K. We talk about making sure that parents have the freedom and the resources to have childcare options, affordable childcare options. I approach it from a less government regulation standpoint. We have some really crazy regulations in this country. Some places say you have to have a four-year college degree. Well, that certainly makes it harder to find childcare workers, the increases in cost because of it. Other places say, well, if you're certified in one state, it's not reciprocal in another. And it's just, you know, having some of those approaches that can be easy to fix, fast to fix, not controversial, that can pass out of a Republican-controlled House, Democrat-controlled Senate, and get to a Democrat president's desk to be signed into law, that's what we've got to be working on.
So what do the two of you agree on?
Well, first of all, as divided as we are as a country, 86% of Americans believe that we need more support for affordable child care. This is something that unifies Americans. We have agreement on more training for child care workers, paying them more and having more flexibility. We have an agreement on some support, government policy support for child care. The average cost of a family for child care is $10,000 a year. And 85% of women say that they can't work because of child care issues if they're leaving the workforce. So we need a short-term solution, which is continuation of some of the grants and funding, the Child Care Stabilization Act, so we don't have this cliff and that the president signs. And then we need a long-term solution to reduce the cost to families.
Experts say doing that alone would cost $16 billion. Congresswoman, you spoke earlier about the fact that you feel that both President Trump and President Biden presided over too much spending. But a lot of the solutions here, experts say, cost money. Universal pre-K, fully funding the Child Care Development Fund, subsidizing child care for low-income families. What could you live with, and what do you think you could convince fellow Republicans to get on board for?
Well, I actually think it's less government, not more, that's getting in the way of this. We saw in December of 2018 when the Azar report came through making recommendations to states about healthcare policy and certificate of need. The same kind of thing could be said for what are some of the easy, low-hanging fruit regulations that we can roll back or eradicate or recommend go away.
Do you think rolling back regulations alone, though, can really get at the
problem? It's a good start, because right now we're going to have a very difficult time with the appropriations process because of the amount of spending that's going on, because of the additional supplementals. What are some of the small parts that will make a big difference
in a mom's life. And that is one thing that I think a lot of us can agree on. It's not going to be easy. We do some large comprehensive spending package. It's going to have difficulty going through. So I'm looking for the small parts, big difference here policy-wise.
This is an investment that is pro-economic growth. I mean, businesses are losing billions of dollars because we don't have people in the workforce. So it pays for itself. And then you look at the funding. You're talking about less than 1% of the defense budget. We're one of the only countries that is putting $10,000 of burden on ordinary families just to take care of their kid. It's pro-family, it's pro-economic growth, and we should have a consensus in this country to have the government make a difference here.
We can incentivize businesses, too, and make sure that parents have the money to be able to afford childcare. Less taxes would be great.
It is so important because we've seen study after study that shows that early childhood education makes such a huge difference in outcomes later in life. So we really hope you're successful, Congresswoman Nancy Mace, Congressman Ro Khanna. Appreciate it, and appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
This Monday marks the 60th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech that he made at the 1963 March on Washington.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
Yesterday, thousands marched to honor the anniversary, a continuation of Dr. King's dream, with many echoes of the past and concerns about the challenges facing the civil rights movement today. Among those who spoke, Dr. King's granddaughter, Yolanda King.
60 years ago, Dr. King urged us to struggle against the triple evils of racism, poverty, and bigotry. Today, racism is still with us. Poverty is still with us. And now, gun violence has come for our places of worship, our schools, and our shopping centers.
A powerful message. We'll discuss that with our political panel. Joining us now, Robert Costa is our chief election and campaign correspondent. David Becker is our CBS News election law contributor. And we're also joined by congressional correspondents Scott McFarlane and Nicole Killian, a double billing. Thanks to all of you for being here. What prescient words by the granddaughter of Martin Luther King just a few hours before that shooting, talking about racially animated shootings taking place across the country. Nicole, you know, here we are 60 years later, still a lot of challenges.
Yeah, really striking. Of course, that was King's granddaughter. We also heard from Martin Luther King III, Dr. King's son, King's wife. But, you know, really being out there on the mall yesterday, 60 years later, it was palpable the amount of frustration and concern there is 60 years later. You know, we talk about how far we have come as a country, and yet for many, particularly in the African-American community, there's a sense that we're still fighting the same battles, whether that's issues of hate crimes and racial violence, whether that's the issue of the rollback of affirmative action, voting rights. So those were some of the concerns articulated at the march yesterday, and also a call to action to continue to keep fighting some of these issues so that one day Dr. King's dream can be realized. That certainly was the message expressed.
A call to action earlier in the show today by former Vice President Mike Pence as well. Robert, I want to talk to you about the former president, President Trump, who is now, he's been booked. He's got a mugshot. He's raising a lot of money using that mugshot. What can you tell us about the legal strategy that his team has right now, particularly after he has changed his legal team in the Atlanta case?
Good to be with you. He has shaken up his legal team in Georgia. What to watch now is the difference between his strategy and the strategy of his co-defendants in this Georgia case, a sprawling prosecution using RICO, racketeering charges, to get this large group of defendants together. Kenneth Chesbrough, who authored a memo suggesting alternate electors should be organized by Trump people, he is pushing for a speedy trial. So is Sidney Powell, another co-defendant who infamously urged Trump to use the government to seize voting machines in the weeks after the 2020 election. But Trump himself is not pushing for a speedy trial because it could have political complications based on our reporting here at CBS News. He could be called as a witness during the fall, just as debates are heating up and the primaries and caucuses loom on the horizon. What you're also watching in Georgia right now is the push by Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff, to have this trial move from being a Georgia case at the state Fulton County level to being a federal case. So there are many dynamics at play, multiple legal fronts, all as the political battleground also unfolds.
David, you're a lawyer. Robert just mentioned these co-defendants who are looking for a speedy trial. Why would they want a speedy trial? Why would they want their lawyers to have less time to prepare for this?
Well, they might feel that they already know the facts of this case and they're prepared to go to trial. There might be a variety of tactical reasons they might be moving in that way. And the court's ultimately going to have to decide how to sever all of these defendants and place them into different court cases at different times. Or they could ultimately all be tried together as well if there's some way to reconcile that. But that's something that the lawyers and the clients are obviously discussing and trying to figure out. And this is where we're really going to see the tension between the defendants. These defendants aren't all unified in their claims, and some of them may do better if others of them do worse. And so we're going to see that played out over the next several months as these tactical considerations are made.
We know that Donald Trump does not want a speedy trial in this case or any of the cases. In fact, in D.C. tomorrow, there's going to be a hearing about one of his federal cases where his lawyers have pushed to have the trial in 2026. Are they going to be successful with that motion, Scott?
We will find out tomorrow, 10 a.m. Eastern time. The judge in Washington, D.C. determines the trial date. And this is a Mars and Venus type of world. The prosecution wants it January 2nd. And as you mentioned, Trump's team wants it 2026. There are some reasons for optimism for Jack Smith going into this hearing. First of all, the early hearings in this case have moved crisply. They've had a quick schedule and the judge has met all the early deadlines. And the judge has said if Donald Trump continues with vitriolic social media posts, she's inclined to move the trial date earlier to avoid tainting the jury pool. And there's also the other matter of there are many other cases going on and this schedule's getting clogged quickly. A January or early 2024 trial might suit some purposes. And Nancy, by so many accounts, this case, the one in D.C., is built for efficiency.
I want to ask you, Nicole, about the vitriolic social media posts that Scott just eloquently described. The judge in, or the DA, rather, in Atlanta has a different bond agreement with Donald Trump than with any of his other co-defendants. Basically, he has to refrain from attacking fellow witnesses, defendants, on social media or anywhere else. Based on what we know of Donald Trump, which is that he attacks lots of people all the time on social media, how likely is it that he is going to live up to that agreement?
Well, it remains to be seen. I mean, we also know that he's very verbose on the campaign trail and doesn't really hold back when it comes to going after the prosecutors in this case. But he does have to be very careful. We know that he has a new counsel in Georgia. I would imagine maybe conversations would be had about those parameters to reaffirm them. But certainly the fact that the former president turned around and put his mugshot on social media in such a short period of time, raised some $7.1 million off of that, shows that, you know, he is trying to capitalize off of this case. So it's certainly likely he could go after some of these witnesses, continue to go after prosecutors. But if he's being smart about it and listening to his counsel, hopefully he won't.
A lot of people wondering why a billionaire would have to go through a bail bondsman to post a $200,000 bail.
Well, this is a case where Trump is just trying to get his bearings now in Georgia. He got rid of his lawyer, Drew Finley. But the political consequences of all this, they're watching Trump get a bail bondsman in Georgia, the rest of the field. I was in Milwaukee this week covering the debate. And they're just wondering, is there ever a moment where this all becomes too much? For now, Republican voters are rallying behind Trump. They're buying his mugshot on coffee cups or on T-shirts. But the Republican race, and I was hearing this from candidates and their top strategists out in Milwaukee this week, they're saying that down the line, this could become such a burden on Trump's time, on his political energy, that maybe they start to break through. That's why they're not going at him directly in most cases. You heard some criticism, of course, from Vice President Pence, former Vice President Pence, and former Governor Christie in your conversations today. But beyond those two, they're really hovering around Trump's candidacy, trying to build their own message should there ever be a collapse with Trump. But as we know with the Republican Party, it might never come. They might always stick by Trump.
Certainly gets difficult to schedule campaign rallies if you're expected in court every other day. David, I want to go big picture here because you are an election law expert. And I'm just wondering, because you speak to secretaries of state and election officials in various states all the time, how do they feel now that the former president, many of his aides, have actually been charged with crimes connected to the 2020 election, which, as we know, was not rife with fraud, as the former president continues to argue?
Yeah, it's 1,027 days since that November in 2020 election, the most scrutinized election in American history, with more paper ballots, audits, recounts, more pre-election litigation, more post-election litigation confirming the results than ever before. And election officials are still, to this day, almost 3 years after that, having to debunk lies about that election, having to defend their own patriotism, their own service to our country, playing an endless game of whack-a-mole. But I think they are seeing an accountability coming to those who have spread those lies for so long. It's not just the criminal cases. It's also the civil defamation case against Fox News. It's also the disbarment proceedings against people like John Eastman and Rudy Giuliani. There is a sense that accountability is coming, and they want this to play out according to how the legal system is supposed to work. And it is working that way right now. And so what we hope to see is that there is a cooling down, because right now there are tens of millions of Americans who still believe that Republicans and Democrats are conspiring to steal elections. And that's just false. And we know it's false.
A lot of election workers who got death threats, who continue to get death threats because of some of the things that people are saying about the election. David Becker, Robert Costa, Nicole Killian, Scott McFarland, thank you all for being here today. Appreciate it. We'll be right back.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be. Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back. Russia's investigative committee confirmed today that the remains of Wagner leader Yevgeny Prigozhin have been positively identified, along with the nine others who died in a plane crash last week. We're joined by Fiona Hill, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a former White House Russia expert. Good morning, Fiona. Thank you so much for being here. So Russian President Vladimir Putin claims he had nothing to do with this. Is there anyone in the diplomatic community who believes that?
I doubt it. And look, I think what we can certainly say is he didn't order it not to happen, because there are plenty of people who were painting a target on Prigozhin's back. The system itself expected him to be taken out of the picture in some fashion. I guess it was a question about what the method would be. And in fact, I think over the last 2 months there's been more shock, not just internationally, but also domestically, based on source reporting, that the fact that nothing had happened to Prigozhin and that he was allowed to walk around as if he hadn't indeed perpetrated a putsch exactly 2 months ago.
You know, usually Putin's enemies tend to get poisoned or pushed out windows or shot. Why go to the trouble of bombing an airplane?
Well, we don't even know exactly how the aircraft was brought down yet, but I guess we'll find out more as things go along. I mean, I'm sure, again, that the Russian government, the Kremlin, will accuse all kinds of other people about carrying out this act if it seemed to be the result of an explosive device, you know, for example. But it's so dramatic, it's so spectacular, that, of course, one has to ask whether this was done for just the demonstrative effect of it. And we have had some mysterious plane crashes in the past, taking down Russian leaders. There was a very famous general, Alexander Lebed, for example, who died in a helicopter crash. So it's not something that is unheard of. And in other settings as well, of course, we've had Pakistan, Bangladesh, China, where there have been the loss of key people in plane crashes. So I think this is par for the course, unfortunately.
And there is some symmetry, isn't there, to Prigozhin's dash to Moscow in that aborted mutiny when the Wagner group brought down several Russian aircraft.
Exactly. So this is also part of that idea of he who lives by the sword dies by the sword, an eye for an eye, the vengeance factor. It's baked into the system. There was a lot of clamor from the uniformed military and especially the Air Force for some kind of retribution for this, whether it was in a legal form. But look, he took down a proportional number of people in a Russian military aircraft, as you've just said here. So again, there is a symmetry and a symbolism in all of this that is inescapable in the Russian domestic context, as well as for the rest of us watching it from the outside.
The Wagner Group has been so pivotal for the Russian military in the war in Ukraine. Now there are reports that the Russian government is requiring Wagner fighters to sign loyalty oaths. What is this going to mean, the death of Yevgeny Prigozhin? What will it mean for the war in Ukraine?
Well, I don't think it'll actually mean anything significant for the war in Ukraine in terms of the military campaign itself. We were already seeing that Wagner was being pulled out or was pulling out after the actions in Bakhmut, where they were in the thick of the fighting there in that city that, of course, you know, was so much of the focus of the carnage of the war over the last several months. But it was already a precipitating factor in all of this series of events over the last 2 months. The idea that the Wagner Group were going to be dismantled and reincorporated, or incorporated for the first time, rather, into the Russian military. And that was one of the factors that Prigozhin himself was citing as a reason for him making his march on Moscow. He didn't want to have his guys put under the command of the central Russian military. So I think, you know, what we can see from all of this is that Wagner was pretty crucial for these early stages, this first couple of parts of the campaign in Ukraine. And now the Russian government and Putin wants to have more centralized control. He gave Wagner a long leash, and Prigozhin clearly took that leash far too far.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're such a close study of Vladimir Putin. You've sat across the table from him. How should we think about his power in Russia now after this likely assassination? There was a period of time after Prigozhin made that dash to Moscow where it seemed like elites, commentators in Russia felt more comfortable speaking out against Putin, against the war. He appeared to be weak. How does his standing look to you now?
Well, and not only were other commentators speaking up, but Prigozhin himself said this war was a mistake. Mm-hmm. But it was basically he was acting because he wanted to make sure that the war was won. And that was kind of part of the theme of his revolt. Now, other commentators, as you rightly said, including, you know, some senior generals, have been bashed back and put out of the picture for saying the same kinds of things. What Putin is saying with this assassination, whether, you know, he actually carried out or not, the message is going to be very clearly transmitted to everybody. Speaking out now. Buckle down. Everyone getting behind this campaign in Ukraine. That's why I say I don't think it's really going to change the way that the Russians are approaching this. And there is no room whatsoever for disloyalty. One of the things that Putin said that was very notable when the mutiny, the putsch was happening 2 months ago, is that the traitors who carry this out will have an inevitable punishment. We've seen an inevitable death as a result of this, that everyone was foretold. I mean, we've all been expecting something like this for the last 2 months. The message to the whole system is don't try anything. And even don't criticise, I would say, at this particular point, because we've seen so much action against people who have been speaking out.
And Prigozhin may not be the last to be targeted. Fiona Hill, Russia expert, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
And that's it for us. Thank you for watching. For Face the Nation, I'm Nancy Cordes. Today's guests were 2024 candidates, former Vice President Mike Pence and former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, California Democrat Congressman Ro Khanna, South Carolina Republican Congresswoman Nancy Mace, and former White House Russia expert Fiona Hill. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. This broadcast was directed by Shelley Schwartz. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation at CBS Radio News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our CBS News streaming network at 1:30, 4, and 10 p.m. on Sundays. And it's available through our apps, CBS News and Paramount Plus.
If you like Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Survivor's back, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. And we have a twist, a new co-host, the winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares.
Hi!
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.